This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. Today we're going to the Philippines, famous for its 7,000 islands and beautiful beaches. If you've been a tourist there, you might have seen the Banao rice terraces carved into a mountain and cultivated for 2,000 years, and we'll hear a song from there today. If I went there, I'd like to see the historic towns of the Spanish colonial period, but mostly I'd like to meet some of the brave climate campaigners who are motivated by being in one of the most vulnerable countries for cyclones and floods.
I felt like there's more action and progress happening in my hometown and in my country, more than I see in the legislation halls of the United Nations. There's more leadership in my community than I see in the global halls, you know. But seeing what's happening at Santa Marta and then they're carrying it forward to Tuvalu, it's been so amazing to see that multilateralism can keep shifting.
It is also one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be a climate activist or land defender. The phrase red tagging, which means they are falsely labeled as communist rebels, means that activists can be killed by the military in extrajudicial killings. This has been well documented by Nobel Prize winning journalist Maria Ressa, as well as by Global Witness and Amnesty International. A survey of climate scientists showed that online harassment has made them so reluctant to comment that they won't discuss climate change online. In places where the military have killed or harassed Indigenous communities for critical mineral developments, the people too often find themselves denounced with trumped-up terrorism charges. And yet, sometimes the people win. The Goldman Prize in 2012 drew attention to the people of Mindoro Island. They went on a huge hunger strike led by their priest, Father Edwin Garrigues. It was to protect the water and forests of their island and to preserve the climate that you have when those things are intact. We're starting to realize with the Amazon that the whole global climate depends on these tropical forests and waterways remaining intact. He brought international attention to their cause, and he pressured the Filipino government to uphold its own laws, which would have prevented this mine going ahead anyway. And so the license to a Norwegian nickel mine company was withdrawn. Today we're going to speak to Krishna Ariola. She is the founding convener of Coal Free Negros and a leader with Youth for Climate Hope. Her province of Negros Occidental is considered the renewable energy capital of the Philippines, and not one coal-fired power station has been built on her beautiful island since the campaign began. Krishna Ariola is with us from the Philippines. This is one of the countries most vulnerable to tropical cyclones, and these are intensified by climate change, as everybody knows. She's a prominent Filipina climate justice activist and has represented her country at the United Nations. So I'm curious to find out the long history of campaigns, and especially by women, which resulted in the cancellation of several major projects that she was part of the final clincher where they banned new coal-fired power. In Negros Occidental, where she lived, Krishna was part of a huge youth-led campaign And the result was the ban on coal-fired power in that whole province. And I think now the whole country has a moratorium on new projects. So, welcome, Krishna. You said at that time, I love this quote somewhere, you said, "Hope is our currency. A single act can inspire millions to rise and abandon apathy." Do you still feel that today?
Hi, Vivian. Thank you so much for inviting me here. And that quote brings me back to so many years ago. Actually, I don't think I've heard or read that in a while. I tend not to like read the stuff that I've written or said before. But yeah, I think I still do for some reason. It's been 8 years since that campaign, where we stopped a coal-fired power plant, a 300 megawatt power plant by one of the biggest energy companies in the Philippines. They're what we call our carbon majors, basically. I think we're still riding that wave. I'm still working in the energy space, and every day I see a lot of communities and a lot of people really step up and respond to the need to really shut down all of these fossil fuel projects and try to build something new. So I feel like I still feel that way because every day we lose hope in a way, but at the same time, every day I find that bit of hope elsewhere. And it's usually with the people I work with, the communities at the front lines, and in the most unlikely of places, people who remind me that, there's still something to fight for.
Can you tell us some examples of that, the front lines?
So what we were working on in 2018, that was again against a 300 megawatt coal-fired power plant in my hometown. I was in college at that time. I was fresh off college, actually. We were already building campaigns against like plastic pollution. We were building campaigns for forest conservation and awareness. And we were faced with this project, this 300 megawatt project that seemed indestructible. And with the help of my friends, maybe we can get into it later. Yeah, we were able to really put together a force to stop that. And nowadays, I see that too. Of course, I came from a very youth-led and women-led background, but then I also see this happening in different sectors. For example, right now in Batangas, which is the area that is where most of the fossil gas or LNG projects are going to be built, the fisher folk are leading the way. They're the ones that are talking about, climate change. And for a country that's very, very vulnerable to climate change, actually, a lot of people don't really connect the typhoons, the cyclones that are happening in our country to climate change directly. And so for me to hear people at the front lines, daughters of fishermen that I've worked with, we're painting murals together, and they tell me about their experiences. All they want is to go back to the open sea with their father every day on their little boat. That's all they want. I'm reminded of why we should help preserve what we still have right now. And yeah, and I see that everywhere else. It's not just fisher folk, it's women, it's even religious and church leaders like interfaith all across Luzon, Visayas, and Mindanao.
Well, yeah, I know you've been collecting stories from the people before you. You know, we all stand on other people's shoulders, and I now meet people who are young, and they don't realize the Australian, climate movement, how many battles there have been and wins. You know, there've been setbacks and losses, court cases lost, and then court cases that have One, people have made little films about them, but it all seems to just get washed down the river and washed down the river. And then the next generation comes along and says, "Oh, it's too late, it's too hard." I don't know. You've been collecting the stories of those earlier generations. You want to tell us about some of those people? Tell us about the individuals.
So we won our campaign in 2018, but halfway between that campaign is when we realized that Our island actually carried a longer history of fighting against gold lands. And I started digging. And just like you said, I found out that for the last 2 decades, women in our community, in different cities and municipalities in our province, they were the ones that had also successfully stopped four gold land projects in the province. Well, we had to focus on the work we were doing on our campaign, and we won it in 2019. And then subsequently in 2022, we won against a gas project. But it was not until after that that I started digging more into it. I got interested in archiving our history. Our hometown and our island is known for a lot of things, mostly like violence and militarization, like the sugarcane industry and feudalist, powers that are still in there. But people do not know that there's also this story of resistance all throughout these years since 1997. That was the year I was born. And, our grandmothers, our grandparents were already on the streets fighting for us. And so it's been such a wonderful journey. I think in the last few months, we've been working with Doc Romana de los Reyes. She's an anthropologist. She was the one who led the anti-coal fight in our province. And the most coincidental thing is that she's an anthropologist. So she was able to keep records of everything, every
Oh,
single thing, even the
yeah.
flyers they were handing
Yeah.
out, the handheld fans that they were giving out. And she has them all in some folder or in some box, and we're like taking them out of storage and trying to scan all of these documents and seeing
Yeah.
how they were combating disinformation at the time without social media, right?
Oh,
And
yeah.
it's just so fascinating, all of this interplay. I feel like I'm going backwards and forwards in
Yeah.
time because it almost seems like history is repeating itself, in iterations. The battle we were facing in 2018 was the clean coal narrative.
Yeah.
And of course, local politicians believing the economic promises of these energy projects, these energy companies, and they were doing the same before then. And that's also what brought us to really decide to document this because we have a lot to learn. Some things are already repeating, but if we have some sort of like blueprint to look back to, there are mistakes that we don't have to repeat,
Yeah.
There are things that we don't have to relearn from scratch. We always have mentors to look back on. We always have people to talk to because there's a lot of people that exist that have been doing this work, but life gets in the way. And so it's a really good reminder, not just for our hometown, our island, but for people all across the Philippines, that we're only here because of the people who put in the work all these years ago, whether they were documented or not. And
Yeah.
for an archipelago like the Philippines, we have 7,000 islands. There are
Ah.
thousands and millions of stories that are lost, right?
Yes.
And we really want to bring what we can from then to today, and hopefully we can, learn from that and also share that to other communities. And
Yeah.
basically, also tell them that, yeah, our story is inspiring, but more likely than not, you also have these stories just waiting to be discovered in your
Yeah.
own hometown. And
Well, you
you have
mentioned
elders to ask for us now.
hope before. I've come to the idea that it's not just hope, it's courage, and courage is contagious. So if you tell those stories, a lot of those people must have been, well, they won some battles, but they must have, it's quite dangerous in the Philippines to be an activist. I mean, I know that there's many people just get disappeared or dreadful things can happen, tortured. So, I'd like to know a little bit your story. How did you end up at the UN? You did that big battle in 2018, and then you were at the United Nations. And Have you had that feeling of threats and social media and all this? Has it been dangerous for you, or how have you persevered? Maybe it hasn't been dangerous for you, but you must have known people for whom it's been really terrible.
Yeah, I think we really grew up as activists, just fearing everything because we hear all of these stories from our parents. My parents were also activists during the martial law, so we don't run out of stories of their artist friends who became disappeared basically by the state, and we hear all of these killings that are happening every year. And again, the Philippines is the number one most dangerous country to be an environmental activist in Asia, if I'm not mistaken. And also, it's not just for environmental defenders, also for journalists
Yes.
and people that are fighting for social justice. And yeah, I have felt threatened a lot of times, in various levels. Of course, I'm very active, not just in the environmental space, but also in the political space, since climate and the environment is very political here. And during presidential elections, I've had people threatening me via message, and I didn't really take it seriously until they started contacting my university. Like, they were able to find my university. I think young people call that doxing nowadays. They were able to find my university. They were able to even find my high school and like put out this message, just trying to slander me, thousands and thousands of people, And while that didn't really affect, my job or my economic standing, just because I'm surrounded by activists as well, it really did put me to in a position where I had to deactivate, where I had to answer a lot of questions, where there have been several things where we were threatened by army in our community, and we were helped by elders that had access or networks, and we were able to smooth it over. But yeah, it's been all of these years of negotiations going back and forth, making sure that we were vouched for, that what we were doing is legitimate.
On this radio show, I've done a whole series on the Santa Marta Conference in Colombia, and I've got great hopes for this group of willing countries who gathered there just to talk about getting away from the fossil fuel dominance of our economies. I've got great hope and great belief that this will work into a full-scale transition for the global economy. But I noticed that the Philippines government, as well as six city governments from the Philippines, were at Santa Marta. Do you see your country as a leader in the transition to clean energy, including the protection of local people, as we've talked about, the dangers of being an activist? Do you think this transition, however, is really starting to be a national image?
Wow, there are two answers to that question for me. Yes, I do think we are leaders as a people, as a community-led movement, but I'm not sure I can say the same for our government leaders. I think it took some like teeth pulling just to be able to have them say yes to Santa Marta. I think even at the last minute, I'm not sure if, the representatives our country had in that conference were able to make significant contributions. Even in the UN, we try our best as delegates, as civil society delegates from the Philippines to talk to the national delegates of the country, and yet we're not supported. They have their own agenda and they're not really fully supporting fossil fuel phase out. So yeah, there's some back and forth in that we can't really afford to happen. We experience 20 typhoons a year and even more, and I don't really think we can afford slow progress at this point. But of course, in the middle of that conversation about transition, there's also this sense of urgency. and sense of justice. And those have to go together. We can't really just move forward without care for the sectors that are going to become vulnerable because of this transition. We also have to make sure it's just. And I see that conversation being nuanced and being opened by so many people in my community. We're talking about the intersection of gender and climate, education and climate. We're talking about, the labor movement and how and what their demands and their calls would be in terms of the just transition. And it's such a difficult conversation, especially since we export a lot of minerals, and critical minerals is also a big thing right now. And it's just this, very difficult thing that we have to get through. And I think, in a way, despite its difficulty, we're making headway because this difficult conversation is coming from the people who are vulnerable and affected themselves, and not really from, from the government leaders who are not so keen on systemic change.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Krishna Ariola is with us from the Philippines.
I've only been to the UN around 3 times, and it has felt so hopeless. I've felt like there's more action and progress happening in my hometown and in my country, more than I see in the legislation halls of the United Nations. There's more leadership in my community than I see in the global halls, But seeing what's happening at Santa Marta, and then they're carrying it forward to Tuvalu, it's been so amazing to see that multilateralism can keep shifting. And these are all rules that I don't understand, And I just find myself thinking, wow, that's possible for people who are agreeing to create basically another conference and focus on the action, focus on moving forward instead of doing all of these mental acrobatics that are happening right now in the UNFCCC. And that's so inspiring. And I hope that, inspires a new wave of people who have been, who have lost hope, and just like me. And, maybe we can, there's still more that we can do.
Definitely, I agree. It's like a river that's become clogged to me, the United Nations. There's big sort of blocks in the river and it can't move. We might think of an artery, cl blood clot in an artery, but then another little vein takes the blood sideways, or a tributary river takes the water sideways. And this Santa Marta is like that, is taking it sideways, just the willing countries, just the ones who are energetic. I mean, you had six cities, Filipino city governments there. So they know they want to be doing things locally, and they wanted the support that you get in that kind of collaboration. It's very new, but it hardly was reported in the press. I didn't find anywhere, but I think it was terrific. But look, maybe on another level, I also read a headline just this week from Reuters, saying the Philippines is leading the world in the rush to solar power. And I wonder, do you think, well, the Straits of Hormuz crisis has made everyone think about how vulnerable you are if you import fuel? That includes Australia. All our oil is imported, and we start thinking, oh my gosh, we won't
Let's
be able to
see.
run the cars. Yeah. So do you think that maybe like economic pressures will just push?
It's definitely happening, but these changes are also bringing up debates and things that we thought as an energy transition movement we will be talking about in a few years' time, but it's been fast-tracked. We've always feared talking about like the corporate capture of RE and large scale solar, because it's the next big battle, right? I mean,
Yes.
while we want to advocate for renewable energy, it's also such a big problem when you're talking about solar farms displacing, indigenous peoples from ancestral lands, and
Ah.
converting agricultural zones to solar farms. And
Oh,
that's
no.
just the tip of it. There's even like floating solar happening. So even aquaculture is, being rezoned into these solar farms. And it's such a difficult conversation. And I think while, yes, it's for the better, people are now seeing why solar and renewable energy in general is so important. It's important for us to have domestic resources. But at the same time, the energy companies are also dipping their hands into that pot, and they have the most resources, and they can push it forward more quickly. And so, yeah, we're seeing these one of the biggest like coal companies in the Philippines also push for like 200 megawatt like solar farms. So that's around 200 hectares worth of land, right, in the mountains. So they're cutting down trees just to put up all these solar farms. Yeah, and it's also forcing us as a movement to be like, okay, how do we center justice in this conversation now that everyone's talking about it? We just wanted people to talk about it like 3 years ago, and now everyone's talking about it. What do we put into this conversation?
And the critical minerals is another threat to the environment too, and the regulation doesn't seem to be going with it. That's the thing, it's going so fast that the regulation that you need to make it all safe, and like the grid, putting in a grid that you can feed all that solar power into. That's the infrastructure that you need help. A country like the Philippines must need help, foreign investment or, intergovernmental help like they're talking about at Santa Marta, and a legal framework that will make it all future-proof, like it'll go into the future. Otherwise, it's just yet another capitalist, horror show.
Yeah, definitely.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Just, I'd like to finish, Krishna. It's so interesting to hear all about this. I don't read about any of this in the our newspapers here, but in Australia, we also worry about state capture of our gold, coal and gas, and we are still approving new projects for export. We export liquefied fossil gas to you, and also indirectly through Japan. And I'd like to know, what message do you have for activists in Australia? We're all in this global climate crisis. We're fighting different battles, maybe some of the same ones, but what do you have to say to us?
When I was starting out as a youth activist, one of the things that really inspired me actually was the show of numbers during the global climate strikes in Australia. I think it was around 60,000 to 70,000 each in Sydney and Melbourne, and I think I've met so many young activists there as well. It was so amazing, it was like a mycelial network. We were just feeding off all of this young energy, and I had like 12-year-olds. I was around 19 at this time. I had 12-year-olds message me like organizing radio shows for young people in Australia as well. And I think in some way I've been able to see a glimpse of it, and it's inspired me so much. And I actually work with a lot of Australian advocates and activists right now, and biologists, in bringing more accessible education about the climate to social media. And it's just been so inspiring. And I think it's so important what we're doing. We have to continue doing it. I know that, it seems so impossible, but if we're able to cut across distances and talk to each other and understand each other across all of these cultural differences, I think, there's so much more that we can do together. And Tuvalu is coming up, and maybe we'll have some space to collaborate as well in the future, especially, since we're the Pacific Island nations that are leading this really great conversation are just between our countries as well. So I'm so looking forward to what we can do together. I'm very much aware as well that, I've gone from being a youth activist to now still being a young activist, but now working more on the side that my younger self would not have wanted to be in, the more technical side. And yeah, I just wanted to say that this space is for everyone. And as long as people are speaking up, as long as people have hope, as long as people are being brave, it's always going to tide over to not just the next generation, but in the generations moving forward. If people from 3 decades ago were able to inspire us to win our movement, who knows in the future what this movement that we're doing right now is going to ripple into. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you, Vivian. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And your story is very instructive for us. And I can see the common threads in it and the common future battles ahead that we also have. I'd just like to know just one last little thing. Do you have much community radio in Philippines? Like, is this type of radio that's made by independent people, not government radio, not commercial radio? Do you have much of that?
Yeah, I don't think so. At least it's not being, widely distributed. But there are some, independently produced podcasts or shows up on social media and YouTube, and they would have some following, but it's mostly like, entertainment and pop culture centric. That's
Yeah.
how they're able to get the audience, right?
Yeah,
But,
that's true.
political issues, there's only very, very few. So maybe that's what we need
Yeah,
to
I
learn.
think it's a great place to explore things in depth. So thank you very, very much. I've loved talking to you, and it was so nice to prepare for this by reading about what you're doing in the Philippines, which is a lot more inspiring than I'd heard about in our media here. So thank you very much. We've been talking to Krishna Ariola, who is in the Philippines. Here is some music from the Bunau Rice Terraces, recorded by Kev 888.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's only just.
Another inspiring leader from the Philippines is Yep Sanyo. When he was executive director of Greenpeace, he said, "I've lost loved ones to climate change, and I want big oil companies to pay." He said that so many lives are wrecked by typhoons that when you visit a cemetery in the Philippines, often there are 10 or more names on the headstone. So here is Yep Sanyo at the 2013 UN Climate Conference in Warsaw, which happened at the same time as the worst cyclone in history, Super Typhoon Haiyan.
Mr. President, the picture in the aftermath is ever slowly coming into clearer focus. The devastation is colossal. And as if this is not enough, another storm is brewing again in the warm waters of the Western Pacific. I shudder at the thought of another typhoon hitting the same places where people have not yet even managed to begin standing up. to anyone outside who continues to deny and ignore the reality that is climate change, I dare them to get off their ivory towers and away from the comfort of their armchairs. I dare them to go to the islands of the Pacific, the Caribbean, the Indian Ocean, and see the impacts of rising sea levels, to the mountainous regions of the Himalayas and the Andes, to see communities confronting glacial floods, to the Arctic, where communities grapple with the fast-dwindling sea ice sheets, the large deltas of the Mekong, the Ganges, the Amazon, the Nile, where lives and livelihoods are drowned, to the hills of Central America that confront similar monstrous hurricanes, to the vast savannas of Africa, where climate change has likewise become a matter of life and death as food and water become scarce. Not to forget the monster storms in the Gulf of Mexico and the eastern seaboard of North America, as well as the fires that have raced down under. And if that is not enough, they may want to see what has happened to the Philippines now. Mr. President, I need not elaborate on the science, as Dr. Pachauri has done that already for us. But it tells us simply that climate change will mean increased potential for more intense tropical storms. And this will have profound implications on many of our communities, especially those who struggle against the twin challenges of the development crisis and the climate crisis. And typhoons such as Haiyan and its impacts represent a sobering reminder to the international community that we cannot afford to delay climate action. Warsaw must deliver on enhancing ambition and should muster the political will to address climate change and build that important bridge towards Peru and Paris. It might be said that it must be poetic justice that the typhoon Haiyan was so big that its diameter spanned the distance between Warsaw and Paris. Mr. President, in Doha, we asked, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? If not here, then where? But here, in Warsaw, we may very well ask these same forthright questions. What my country is going through as a result of this extreme climate event is madness. The climate crisis is madness. Mr. President, we can stop this madness right here in Warsaw. We cannot sit and stay helpless staring at this international climate stalemate. It is now time to raise ambition and take action. We need an emergency climate pathway. Mr. President, I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves after perishing from the storm. I speak also for those who have been orphaned by the storm. I speak for those of the people now racing against time to save survivors and alleviate the suffering of the people affected. We can take drastic action now to ensure that we prevent a future where super typhoons become a way of life. Because we refuse, as a nation, to accept a future where super typhoons like Haiyan become a way of life. We refuse to accept that running away from storms, evacuating our families, suffering the devastation and misery, counting our dead become a way of life. We simply refuse to. Now, Mr. President, if you will allow me, I wish to speak on a more personal note. Super typhoon Haiyan, perhaps unknown to many here, made landfall in my own family's hometown. And the devastation is staggering. I struggle to find words even for the images that we see on the news coverage. And I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses. Up to this hour, I agonize, waiting for word to the fate of my very own relatives. What gives me renewed strength and great relief is that my own brother has communicated to us and he had survived the onslaught. In the last 2 days, he has been gathering bodies of the dead with his own two hands. He is very hungry and weary as food supplies find it difficult to arrive in that hardest hit area. Mr. President, these last 2 days, there are moments when I feel that I should rally behind climate advocates who peacefully confront those historically responsible for the current state of our climate. These selfless people who fight coal, expose themselves to freezing temperatures or block oil pipelines. In fact, we are seeing increasing frustration and thus more increased civil disobedience. The next 2 weeks, these people and many around the world who serve as our conscience will again remind us of this enormous responsibility. To the youth here who constantly remind us that their future is in peril, to the climate heroes who risk their lives, reputation, personal liberties to stop drilling in polar regions, and to those communities standing up to unsustainable and climate-disrupting sources of energy, we stand with them. We cannot solve problems at the same level of awareness that created them, as Dr. Pachauri alluded to Einstein earlier. We cannot solve climate change when we seek to spew more emissions. Mr. President, and I express this with all sincerity, in solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, and with my brother who has not had food for the last 3 days, with all due respect, Mr. President, and I mean no disrespect for your kind hospitality, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight, until concrete pledges have been made to ensure mobilization of resources for the Green Climate Fund. We cannot afford a fourth COP with an empty GCF. Until the promise of the operationalization of a loss and damage mechanism has been fulfilled, until there is assurance on finance for adaptation, until we see real ambition and climate action in accordance with the principles we have so upheld. Mr. President, this process under the UNFCCC has been called many, many names. It has been called a farce. It has been called an annual carbon-intensive gathering of useless frequent flyers. It has been called many names, and this hurts. But we can prove them wrong. And today we say, I care. We can fix this. We can stop this madness right now, right here, in the middle of this football field, and stop moving the goalposts. Mr. President, Your Excellency, Honorable Minister, my delegation calls on you most respectfully to lead us and let Poland and Warsaw be remembered forever as the place where we truly cared to stop this madness. If this is our imperative here in Warsaw, you can rely on my delegation. Now, can humanity rise to this occasion? Mr. President, I still believe we can. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
That was Filipino Chief Climate Negotiator Yeb Sanyo, who ended his speech by weeping in his chair. He was speaking Monday at the opening of the UN Climate Change Summit in Warsaw. Special thanks to the International Institute for Sustainable Development for the video. After Yeb Sanyo spoke, several other climate activists attending the talks announced they would join the Philippines' chief climate negotiator, Sanyo, in a hunger fast. Meanwhile, three young climate activists were thrown out of the climate talks Monday just after Sanyo's talk when they unfurled a banner expressing solidarity with the people of the Philippines.
And here is Yeb Sanyo at the 2025 UN Climate Conference in the Amazon. He's reflecting on what has changed. And thanks to Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! For both of these recordings. I think the archives are really important to remind us that we should never give up.
What has changed since that 2013 speech we played a clip of when you were chief climate negotiator for the Philippines at the Warsaw Summit? You went on a hunger strike then. This was 12 years ago.
Well, a lot has changed, more particularly, the impacts that are being felt in many places around the world, especially people who are already struggling to make ends meet. Radical things have changed in terms of their circumstances, in terms of our circumstances, where typhoons have become more intense, and the scientific basis for saying that typhoons is driven by a warmer world has become a lot more clearer now. And there's of course a lot of things that have changed in terms of the global political leadership, if you can put it that way, if you can consider that as part of the worrying change in how many political leaders have abandoned their duty to have a higher ambition on climate. Now, when we ask what else has changed around the regime on climate change, I can say that there are, of course, little steps that have been taken in the UNFCCC, in the Climate Convention. But if you ask me honestly, I think these are little steps and steps that are too little and probably too late. As we can see that the Paris Agreement implementation has become very difficult and has hit a lot of roadblocks along the way. The can is being kicked down the road every year. There's so much watering down of commitments. And you know, there's just a lot of room to be improved in terms of how countries are working together to effect what President Lula has said is the imperative to strengthen multilateralism.
I'm from the Lakota Nation in the geographical center of North America that we call Turtle Island. And community radio is about your community, your heart, which 3CR Community Radio is right here at 85.5 AM. So it is digital, and I'm presuming you can go worldwide with it. People are listening in America to you, so talk back. Australia to the earth. Peace with earth. Thank you. Teokasen Ghost Horse. Community radio is your love.
We've just heard about the progress made in the Philippines since Yebsanyo wept at the 2013 UN Climate Conference in Warsaw. A lot has happened since then. The Philippines is resisting new coal and gas power and installing renewable energy at a great rate. Meanwhile, the Straits of Hormuz crisis has caused oil prices to soar in the Philippines. It has stranded thousands of Filipino oil tanker workers and other mariners. President Marcos Jr. has declared a state of emergency. So I've asked actor Meg Clancy to read a recent article called Oil as Achilles' Heel. Brings together Russia's war on Ukraine and yet another reason why we should transition from oil to renewable energy. It's by famous climate campaigner Bill McKibben, and it's from an American point of view. Thanks very much, Meg.
Oil is Achilles' Heel by Bill McKibben. I visited Omsk once, or at least its airport. We were en route from Moscow to Ulan-Ude on the Mongolian border, and the Aeroflot flight landed us there to refuel. It was a memorable journey. This was still the Soviet Union, and the stewardess handed each passenger a baggie with a scrawny chicken drumstick for an all-day flight. All of which is to say, I'm equipped to pronounce with the gravitas proper to a pundit that Omsk is a long ways from anywhere else, including the Ukrainian border, which makes it remarkable that Zelensky's zone specialists managed to fly a whole squadron of their craft more than 2,500 kilometres from home and bombed the heck out of Putin's largest oil refinery. It was a high point of an ongoing campaign designed to highlight what may be Russia's greatest weakness. That is, like a number of other countries, it is heavily dependent on oil. Just as Donald Trump has proposed building American prosperity on the back of energy dominance via liquid gold, oil was supposed to be Russia's strength. And indeed, in the early days of the war, Russia flexed its hydrocarbon muscle, threatening to cut off Europe's gas supply. Throughout its invasion of its neighbour, Russia has relied on the often covert export of oil via a fleet of shadow tankers. Trump, of course, made this easier and more profitable for his buddy by temporarily lifting sanctions in the wake of our own ill-advised attack on Iran. But if our attack on Iran has made other nations demonstrably more nervous about relying on the import of hydrocarbons, Ukraine's attacks on Russia's petroleum network should make them nervous about depending on the stuff, even if they don't have to bring it in from afar. It turns out that in the drone age, it's a very risky business because it relies on colossal pieces of infrastructure that can't be easily defended. One of those is the supertanker. There's one on fire today in the Gulf, apparently hit by an Iranian missile because it strayed from the Tehran-approved shipping lane. Ukrainian drones attacked another yesterday in the Sea of Azov, crippling the vessel. There's essentially no defence for these slow-moving giant ships. If an adversary with a few drones want to take one out, they are, after all, a floating pool of flammable liquid. Another vulnerability is the terminal, where you load and unload the crude. Ukraine got one of those yesterday too, in occupied Crimea. And third, and perhaps most exposed, is the refinery. An oil refinery is one of the most specialised pieces of equipment humans have ever built. That means that they're highly vulnerable. If you aim your drones well, maybe it will smash, say, the LU-11 unit, which at Omsk is what they call the thing that does the initial distillation and desalinization of the crude. Without it, the secondary units that produce, say, gasoline and jet fuel have nothing to work with. And this is highly complicated equipment, not easy to replace, given Western sanctions. The current guess is 6 months to a year. And it's not as if Ukraine has hit just that refinery. In fact, it was one of the last squares on a drone pilot's bingo card. It's also worth remembering that Ukraine has already hit all 10 of Russia's largest refineries, some of them more than once. That means it's no longer a single plant waiting for repairs. It's effectively all of them at once, which piles additional pressure on repair crews and on the supply of replacement parts that are hard to source under sanctions. Russia started this energy war, of course. Over the years of the conflict, it has targeted heating plants and the like, trying to freeze the fighting spirit out of the Ukrainians during their long winters. It's been effective at producing cold, but not at winning the war, along with the attacks on schools, hospitals, and other civilian targets. It seems to have helped reinforce the Ukrainian will to resist. Now, with far more attention to avoiding civilian casualties, the Ukrainians are striking back at defense plants and especially at refineries. As Zelensky said this morning, the very idea of Russia having a strategic rear is gone. For a long time, Russia believed it had territorial advantage no one else possessed, a deep rear where it could safely keep everything its war depends on, believing no one could reach them. We have reached them. But of course, what's at stake here is not just the oil that the Russian war machine runs on. In Russia, as in America, almost everything runs on oil. I remember that the one and only time that I sat down with Barack Obama, the first thing he told me was that the price of gasoline is the most salient fact in American politics. If that's even close to the case in Russia, Putin better watch out. In occupied Crimea, gasoline prices are going above $10 a gallon. The government is desperately trying to import gasoline from as far away as India. In Russia, mass fatigue with the war is turning into mass irritation, said Andriy Kolesnikov, a Moscow-based political analyst. Even so, he said, the shortages were unlikely to trigger widespread protests in Russia's tightly controlled political system. There is certainly shock, but the lack of any real means of influencing the situation and the risks associated with trying to do so makes protests unlikely. This seems likely to get worse. Russian horse breeders are reporting a surge in sales because a steed is now cheaper to maintain than a car. Ukraine has stood up to Russia's attacks on its energy infrastructure, mostly by starting to diversify. The country is undergoing a rapid renewables revolution. According to estimates from the Solar Energy Association of Ukraine, the nation has installed at least 1.5 gigawatts of new solar generation in 2025, enough to power roughly 1.1 million homes, and grid operators intend to almost double the country's renewable energy production over the next 4 years. Ukraine's energy transition is not a slogan. Since the full-scale invasion, Ukraine has added over 3 gigawatts of new renewable energy capacity. It's a security-driven transformation, unfolding under extreme constraints that prioritizes decentralization, flexibility, and speed of recovery. In the most basic terms, a single missile can take out a gas-fired power plant. You would need around 40 missiles to do the equivalent amount of capacity damage at a wind farm. Solar too makes an unattractive target. Attacking decentralized solar power installations is not economically rational, says Ukrainian energy expert Olena Kondrachuk. Missiles and drones are expensive, and significantly disrupting such systems would require a large number of strikes, while the overall impact on the energy system would remain limited. Both solar and wind parks can function, even when parts of them are out of operation. That's because sun and wind and batteries are not like oil. They're small, interchangeable pieces of infrastructure easily subbed in. There aren't choke points like refineries and tankers and terminals. There's no cascading failure. My roof is covered with solar panels, and I suppose a saboteur could put a ladder against the wall and climb up there with a hammer and do some damage. But it wouldn't shut down the electric grid across New England. It'd be a problem, not a crisis. Which in turn is why no rational saboteur would even bother. Once you can run cars and heat pumps and cooktops off the power those panels and turbines generate, then you're far more protected against attack. If Vladimir Putin had electrified Russia, he would worry less about Ukrainian drones. Of course, if the world ran on electricity, Russia would never have built up the treasury required to act like a bellicose beast. Look, world leaders should be moving quickly to clean energy because it's the one scalable weapon in the war against climate change. But I'll take any motivation, and I'll count it as a real bonus if a cleaner world is also one where it's harder to attack your neighbours because they don't have vulnerable infrastructure. The peace dividend from sun and wind could be very real.
Lastly, to remind you that sometimes treaties are made and respected. Sometimes governments can collaborate to protect the very biosphere we depend on. So here's Bob Hawke, our former Prime Minister in Antarctica, celebrating the Madrid Protocol to prevent mining and protect that whole continent. He signed it with French Prime Minister Michel Rocard in 1991.
I just could not believe that civilized nations of the world were going to really destroy the pristine quality of the last remaining pristine continent. You just imagine mining down here and the accidents that could occur and the destruction of this pristine environment. I was determined that it shouldn't happen, and people said we had no chance, but with the cooperation of my good friend Rocard, the Prime Minister of France, and Philippe Gonzalez from Spain, we just set about and we turned it over, which was marvellous. I got a great sense of almost proprietorship of the place because we've been involved in seeing that it was preserved, and therefore it's almost impossible to describe the feeling of pride and excitement that I have being here.
So that was Bob Hawke speaking in Antarctica. 20 years later, at a meeting to celebrate the Madrid Protocol in Hobart, Monsieur Rocard said, "The Antarctic Treaty is a good start to say, stop it. We can be reasonable only if we are together."
And you are listening to the Climate Action Radio Show on Community Radio. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Thank you also to our guests, Krishna Ariola in the Philippines, Yep Sanyo, courtesy of Democracy Now! Archives, and Meg Clancy, who read Bill McKibben's recent article, Oil as Achilles' Heel. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.